This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. And welcome to the serious side of The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Connison with Kusu Chuang and Noel Lim in the studio this morning. Noel Lim,
welcome. Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Always a pleasure to have your company. How are you doing?
I'm good. Waiting to go. And today is Thursday. One more day to the weekend.
I regret asking Noel how she was doing, because now she's made me feel bad about being here. But we've got an exciting show, as we always do. In about 15 minutes, we'll be speaking to Professor Dato' Dr. Adiba Karmalzaman, Dean of Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya, on the rising COVID-19 infection rates, or at least what we saw a few days ago. And so that's happening in about 10 to 15 minutes. In the meantime, let's talk about markets. The US was up. Dow Jones closed up 2.2%. S&P was up 1.5%, breaking past 3,000 points, at closing at 3,036 points. The NASDAQ up just under 1%, 0.8%. I think this was a late rally in US stocks and overcame the escalation in US-China tensions there. We did see some tensions spike up, especially over Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's right. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, of America fame, saying that the US doesn't recognize Hong Kong in the same way that it did in the past. And that's got tremendous implications, because it means that the US has got a range of options available now, including visa restrictions, asset freezes on top of officials, even trade sanctions. And of course, America is also mulling a bill that would censure China for its treatment of Muslim Uyghurs, over a million of them, in Xinjiang province.
And Noel, when you look at the markets, how are the Asian markets doing?
Well, I think the US markets did really well. I think the Dow closed up 2.2%. The S&P 500 was up 1.5%. And it breached 3,000 points, I think, since the start of the coronavirus. And of course, the Asian markets, like you were asking, Nikkei closed up 0.7%. The Hang Seng and SDI, however, were down 0.4%. And Shanghai Composite was also down 0.3%. But the Malaysian markets, FBM, KLCI, closed up 1%.
Yes, I think doing a little bit of catching up after the four-day gap, or the two-day public holiday. Now, for more on global markets, we speak to Vishnu Vardhan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. Vishnu, are you there on the line with us?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for joining us this morning. Now, Singapore unveiled its $33 billion Fortitude stimulus package yesterday. Will it be able to safeguard jobs as intended, or does the government need to do more?
I think what it does is it provides a very good cushion for jobs. So it prevents jobs from being lost unnecessarily insofar that they have ramped up a wage subsidy. And they've gone further. They went around wages and to also provide rental subsidies for SMEs. So this, but the intent behind it is to ensure that otherwise viable businesses need not fold or unnecessarily lay off. However, to your question, the stimulus package on its own cannot save all jobs. You know, necessarily, unemployment will go up, unfortunately, and that's going to be a byproduct of the recession. So the stimulus package is not so much about averting a recession or saving all jobs, but rather trying to shape the best recovery possible after that. But even that is, you know, hugely subject to global forces.
Well, looking at what's happening between US and China and in Hong Kong, increasing US-China tensions and social unrest are once again threatening Hong Kong's status as Asia's financial hub, especially with this oncoming also national security law. What do you think are the challenges, especially if the US imposes sanctions?
I think the challenges are all around. It's not as if the US is not aware that it's walking a very, very fine line. So the balance for them is then to make sure that they look like they are going against China's restriction on autonomy, but at the same time, not in a way that's going to adversely impact Hong Kong's economy. And that, I think, remains a huge challenge. And that may partly explain why markets overnight did not react too adversely to the news. They probably think that there's going to be a softer form of sanctions rather than being against Hong Kong in terms of tariffs, so on and so forth. They think it's going to be more along the lines of asset checks and visa restrictions on Chinese officials and Hong Kong officials aligned with China. So I think that may be the broad thought process, but we could be surprised.
Do you think Singapore is going to be the beneficiary of what's happening in Hong Kong? I know we talked about this earlier, but now is this likely to move on with Singapore?
There's two schools of thought. One is Singapore will get some of the benefits insofar that fund managers, asset managers look to shift out or even Hong Kong citizens to shift out and shift the assets out. But equally, that's a very precarious position in any case, because a wider spillover into China is also going to impact the region overall. So it's going to be a very tentative move that's not completely wholehearted. The other thought is, will China then open up special economic zones in places like Shenzhen and Shanghai in such a way that capital might then move over there? So I think all options remain open, but for now, an unintended consequence may be Singapore benefits to some extent from in the financial sector reallocation, if any.
Yeah, Vishnu, China recently set their yuan reference point at a record low, indicating the concerns over the recovery and, of course, the rising U.S. trade tensions. What kind of a direction do you think is the PBOC looking for the currency to trade in?
You know, despite the appearances and you know, a wisdom against it, I'm inclined to think along the lines that we can take the PBOC at face value. The PBOC as an institution has been quite solid about that. And they've, you know, reiterated over the NPC that they are going to remain a reasonably stable renminbi over this period. So I think the interpretation is that it will be some shock absorption function there, which concedes to dollar strength during these risk-off periods. But overall, renminbi is going to be a lot more stable than the collective basket of Asian currencies. And that's what we've seen generally throughout this crisis and the last few crises anyway. Because I think it is in China's interest to ensure that the renminbi is not destabilized to an extent where you get capital outflows which adversely impact China's economy. So they are also very wary of that after the 2015 episode.
Yeah, Vishnu, on a related note, what do you make of the narrative that there's a transition in economic superiority between the Americans, which is basically devaluing the dollar with the avalanche of credits from the Federal Reserve, and the posturing of China with their desires to become to make the yuan a more internationalized even currency and even potentially a reserve currency for the future?
I mean, that's interesting, and that could be a byproduct, whether intended or otherwise. But there are two key things we need to note here. Whilst the Federal Reserve's huge expansion of its balance sheet after the GFC in 2008 led to an entire period of dollar devaluation on a trend basis right up to 2013, just before taper, that worked during that time. But it may work less effectively this time around, mainly because QE has become more ubiquitously adopted. So, you know, there's a larger movement towards QE outside of the G3, which means alternatives to the dollar or to hedge your dollar debasement risk. You may not get into the Aussie at this point, which is what people did in 08. So dollar may not be able to devalue as effectively. So that's one point. The second and more important point is the US is cognizant of its exorbitant privileges of being a reserve currency. So they'll also make sure that the confidence in the dollar is never lost to the extent where the dollar may be supplanted. And to that extent, you know, dollar weakness may be a phase rather than a continuous thing.
I have this just very quick question. Just, you know, just to get your thoughts. You know, China wants to do this digital currency, DCEP or DCEP. Any quick thoughts about that? Like, I mean, would that challenge the US dollar? I mean, is this China's move to become like the next reserve currency?
I think the initial phases of that is just about increasing access and mobility of the currency. It's just a transition for them. They've become mostly a cashless society anyway. And so rather than being challenged by cryptocurrencies, I think they're creating the base where it can bring down transaction costs, so on and so forth. In the very distant future, it might also improve the movement towards becoming a reserve currency. But the key catalyst to being a reserve currency is it must move to a point where there are enough network effects, so to speak. That includes not only most transactions being done in that currency, but most global assets being held in that currency. And I think just, you know, getting a digital currency around it doesn't necessarily, you know, guarantee a progress towards that point yet.
All right, Vishnu, thank you so much for joining us on the line this morning. That was Vishnu Vardhan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. Now, before we move into a few messages, let's quickly cover this stimulus out of the EU. The European Union has unveiled a stimulus package that could be worth as much as 750 billion euros, a cool 3.5 trillion ringgit in total. 500 billion euros from the package will be distributed in the form of grants to member states, and 250 billion euros could be available in loans. And to fund the package, the EU would borrow up to the 750 billion euros on the financial markets and would be funded by joint debt issuances in a significant step towards closer financial integration.
I think some of the biggest challenges that the EU faced in trying to put this package together was really to win the backing of some of the far richer and more sceptical member states like the Netherlands and Austria. But for sure, I know Germany and France were very keen to put this package together. I think what's really at stake here is really Italy. I think that's the focus. They are facing a spiraling public debt. It has raised questions whether the country will be able to sustain the membership of the euro and whether this might even eventually Italy might just want to leave the union altogether.
Yeah, it's the sanctity of the European Union, right? But one struggles to see how this additional avalanche of credit will help the European Union, which I recall so clearly Mario Draghi of the ECB saying years and years ago that he'll do whatever it takes, right? And he's unleashed billions and billions and billions of euros onto the region, and to no avail. It hasn't really grown its way out of the crisis. It's just gotten itself deeper into the hole. So one struggles to see how another 750 billion euros will aid the effort.
And and on that note, we're going into a few messages right now. And we've got a poll running on Twitter. Are you concerned about a potential spike in COVID-19 infections here in the next 2 to 4 weeks? Let us know over on Twitter what your thoughts here are. Because right after this, we'll be speaking to Professor Dr. Adiba Karmalzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya, on the rising COVID-19 infection rates. Now stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.